brought to you by Penguin.
I think it spoke to people about what they might have lost already, and if they didn't pay attention, might lose more of.
Hello, welcome to the Weekly Penguin Podcast. Now, this is the place where we explore how our writers and artists tap into their creativity by way of a handful of objects that they have chosen. I'm Nihal Arthanaiker, speaking to you today. I've moved room, not in the living room, upstairs in my little office that used to be my daughter's bedroom. So it's got a lovely multicoloured chandelier hanging from the ceiling. Anyway, as well as being a writer, my guest today is an artist in the traditional sense of the word. She's illustrated for The Guardian, New Statesman and Independent, collaborated with the likes of Ted Hughes and has written over 40 books. We're going to talk about a few of her books today, including The Lost Words, Robert McFarlane, which she illustrated. The audiobook is narrated by the likes of Guy Garvey, Benjamin Zephaniah and Kerris Matthews, with sound design by wildlife recordist Chris Watson. Speaking to me from a cottage on the cliffs of Pembrokeshire is Jackie Morris. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
What do you see when you look out of your window?
If I look in the one direction, I see cliffs, loads of birds. Just outside my house, there is a blackthorn hedge. So in the spring, it goes white with tiny pearls of blossom that just kind of burst like a sea spray. And that's just threaded through with tiny birds.
Okay.
It's beautiful now. The sun's just come out and it is absolutely stunning. And definitely time to wander off to a beach.
Could you do what you do if you were based in a city?
I could do it. But I wouldn't be happy.
So this is more about happiness than creativity being in there.
One of the things I learnt during the time that I've been working is that the most important space when you're working is the space between your head, your eyes, and the piece of paper that you're working on. And you see people create in the most extraordinary circumstances. So when I was at college, one of my very favourite artists was Kathy Kollwitz, who made the most amazing drawings in concentration camps. Frida Kahlo spent most of her life in pain, and she painted in bed with huge canvases in front of her, propped up on her knees. I moved to St David's 28 years ago now, and I think it changes the way that I work, but I think you'd have to tie my hands behind my back to stop me painting wherever I was.
But surrounded by the beauty that you are surrounded by surely must fuel the imagination in a way, perhaps looking around at lots of concrete buildings and black cabs and red buses wandering past you at speed would not.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was at college, when I first left, I went to London because I thought if you wanted to work in publishing, you had to live in London. And I was there for maybe 3 months. I loved walking around. I couldn't afford to travel on public transport, so I walked a lot between publishing offices. And in between times, I would walk into museums and galleries. And that was wonderful. You know, you can feed your mind there. But here, I can walk for miles and see nobody other than birds and seals, and the expansiveness that gives to my imagination to let it fly is just wonderful.
We go to Sri Lanka to visit our family, Jackie, every year. Last summer, I particularly noticed how animals were curious about us in a way that in the UK, I always felt they were terrified of us. They knew the history of what we'd done to their species and they wanted nothing to do with us. But living where you live, is there still that curiosity that animals have for you?
There is, yeah. Especially things like this time of year, the seals are just coming to the beaches. They pop on the beaches here. But there's so many seals actually on the coast rather than 20 or 30 miles out at sea. When you're walking, they'll follow you. If you walk with dogs, the choughs and the ravens seem to like to bomb the dogs, really.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
The Lost Words arrived at my house, and my daughter, who's 10, was immediately, as indeed was I, actually. I started, and then she was like, what are you reading? Because it's not the usual book I get sent, Jackie.
It's a bit larger, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit larger than the usual book I said. Not one for a commute, can I just say.
It's a useful luckily, coffee table or a bird hide or, all in a book.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't do that to an award-winning, multi-award-winning book such as this. Can you just talk us through the genesis of The Lost Words?
It came from quite a few sources, really. I'd been reading Landmarks, and in the introduction to Landmarks, Robert McFarlane talks about how a children's dictionary had dropped certain words from its canon and replaced them with other words. So out had gone acorn and bluebell and otter, and in had come chatroom celebrity and something else that I wouldn't want to paint, but I can't remember what it was. Blackberry, I think, meaning phone rather than blackberry, because bramble was one of the words that went. And then I was asked to sign a letter by a poet called Lawrence Rose, which was a kind of plea to the dictionary to reinstate these words. Because how can you explain to a child that a bluebell is important and possibly shouldn't be built on when the word isn't in the dictionary that they grew up with? So I signed this letter, thought nothing more of it for a little bit, except it nagged away at the back of my brain that this was a beautiful list of words and it might make a really nice book. And I wrote to Robert and asked him if he would do the introduction for it. And it kind of grew from there, really. Together, we made something else, something much stronger than what I had originally imagined. But we had no idea that it was going to just land like it did in people's hearts, which was incredible.
Why do you think, Jackie, it did resonate with so many people?
I think it spoke to people about what they might have lost already, and if they didn't pay attention, might lose more of. And then for those people who are in love and in awe with the wilder, wide world, it's like shaking hands, really. Somebody said it was a call to arms, and I said, no, it was a call to link arms, because I'm not one for militaristic language.
Let's go to your first object, which is an hourglass. Why this?
I have this thing about time. Time is gone once it's gone. And when is now? And what is time? And what does it look like? And how can you feel it passing? And when you have an hourglass, you can actually sit and watch time pass as the sun goes through. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes total sense. But why why that rather than why having a digital clock? I mean,
a
I know
clock.
Obviously the prosaic nature of a digital clock, but why the hourglass?
I've got an analog watch now as well, which was my father's. My father died recently, just before lockdown.
Sorry.
And now that he no longer has a need for time, I wear his watch. I haven't worn a watch for years. A digital watch, no, but an analog watch, yes. But there's something about that shape of an hourglass and that sand slipping through.
When you sit down to do an illustration, do you set yourself time to do it? Or is it finished when it's finished?
It's finished when it's finished. Part of the reason that I got the hourglass was because in the digital world, it's so easy to just go, I better just go and check my email. And I was finding that I was spending less and less time at the drawing board and too much time on Twitter. So I thought, I got the hourglass, so I would turn the hourglass, and while the sand was going through for an hour, I wouldn't even let myself go to the loo for a wee. I had to sit there and I had to paint for an hour, and then I could go and be distracted by other things. And what is wonderful is when you turn it, you keep looking, and then eventually you stop looking, and then the sand's all gone through and you're still painting. And it was a way of kind of reconcentrating my brain, really.
What are you trying to get across to us when you're illustrating something beautiful? I'm now looking at the picture of the kingfisher sitting on a branch, the beautiful background.
With the lost words, I was trying to make a kind of praise song to the wild, really. So the gold images were like an echo of an icon, I suppose, except my religion is wild life, not church life. I thought I looked at things closely, but it's not until you really look at a bramble and the way the thorn sits on that thread of briar and the way the leaves cling and that silver underside and just the texture of them. Really close observation.
Let's, Jackie, move to your next object. And you mentioned that your father sadly passed away not that long ago. But it is your father's typewriter. And he was a police officer, is that right?
Yeah, he was a police sergeant in Broadway. And my mum, for their first anniversary, bought him a typewriter. It's a Remington letter writer. And it's very heavy. It's on my desk at all times with some paper in. It smells beautiful because it smells like machine oil. And I need to find where you're supposed to put the oil, actually, because I didn't ask him to show me how to maintain it. But I love it because my mum bought it for him. And I love it because... Oh, I just made a noise with it. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did.
Hang on. Yeah. Can you hear that?
Yeah, I can.
It does as well.
Oh, wow. That's the sound that I grew up with, but that's the sound my kids will never hear.
Oh, you should get them a typewriter. They're fantastic. They really change the way that you think when you're writing, because you can't write and then cross it out and go back. You have to really focus your mind.
As a kid, what was your relationship like to the typewriter? Were you allowed even near it?
It was in the police station.
Ah, right.
So I remember going into the office a few times and seeing it, and it's got racing green coloured keys as well. Once Dad retired and he took it home, that's when I coveted it most.
Now, the other book, Jackie, we wanted to touch on today is The House Without Windows, which you illustrated and wrote an introduction for. I guess it's a lost book in a way because it was written, what, some 90-odd years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
1927 by Barbara Newell Follett, who was 12 at the time. Tell me how this came about.
It's just occurred to me, actually, that she stole her dad's typewriter when she was 4 years old. So she was a bit ahead of me.
But it would have been hard for you to steal something from a police station, I think.
I know.
You'd have to be like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible to do
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, it was a lost book. When it was published in 1927, it was a huge seller, huge bestseller. I first came across it when we were talking, I think on Facebook or something, about how writers tend to write better the older they get, but mathematicians usually have their ideas the younger they are. I don't know whether that's true or not. And somebody said to me, have you heard of this book, The House Without Windows by Barbara Newhall Follett? She wrote it when she was 12. I looked it up online. I found the most amazing quote from Eleanor Fargen saying that it was nothing short of a miracle. But the only one I could find was, there was one that was £700 and there was one that was £140. And the £140 one was for sale through Oxfam. So I thought, I'm going to take a punt on this. And but it's like donating lots of money to Oxfam. And I bought this book and, oh my Lord, it was beautiful. And she was 12 when she wrote it. She wrote it as a present for her mother. And it's a story of a little girl who cannot bear to be indoors in a house. So one day she walks away from home with a little suitcase with some crackers. And she goes and lives wild in the meadow with deer. And then she goes to the sea, and the descriptions of being by the sea and the beauty of the sea and swimming, it's just gorgeous. And then she sees the mountains in the distance and she longs to be by the mountains. So off she goes. How this child writes with a language that is so absent of ego about the natural world is just wonderful.
Tell me about her, herself, Barbara Newell Follett, as she grew up.
So she wrote this book when she was 12, and I'm going to give you a plot spoiler, because at the end of the book, she, the child that she's writing about, puts out her arms and butterflies land on her wrists and then swarm all around her. And then she kind of dissolves and becomes this spirit of nature. So this is her book that she wrote when she was 12. When she was, I can't remember now whether it's 25 or 27, she was walking home from work in an office in Brooklyn, and she disappeared and she was never heard of again. So she wrote half of her life before this prescient novel that connected with what happened in her future life. Nobody knows what happened to her.
I'm astounded by this. I feel like we could talk about Barbara Newell Follett for this entire hour, but we have to move on, because your next object is a tiny gold hare.
Yes.
Why this?
It's a strange thing that belonged to my partner's mother, and her life is fascinating. It is the most exquisite little golden hare on a... It looks like it's on a little platform on wheels. It's no bigger than the end of my finger, exquisitely carved, and it was made by a jeweller's in Germany. It lived its life with her, and her life was quite strange. She was sent to England from Germany because things in Germany were quite difficult. I've spoken to her about this. I think she must have been about 9 when she came over. What happened to her was she was sent to school in England, and my conversation with her began when she was looking at me one day, and I had one of those cardigans on that had 3/4 length sleeves. And she said, "Oh, that reminds me of when I was a child. I grew out of my clothes and I didn't know how to get new ones." And then this whole backstory came out about how she was in England as a child. She was getting letters from her parents, and then the letters stopped. Her school moved north in England, and she was left in London on her own, 14 years old, with no adults, didn't know what was happening to her parents. And they had been taken to a ghetto in Minsk. She was Jewish and she was alone. So this little hare, as far as we know, is one of the few things that she brought with her from Germany. So it has this astonishing story that lives with it. I don't know how she didn't lose it, and I'm terrified of losing it. So it sits on top of one of my hourglasses.
This must be the most extraordinary selection of objects that I've come across doing this podcast. I mean, what that must mean to you and your partner.
Well, I think it's astonishing that he gave it to me, bless him, because he doesn't have that much of his mum's, and he has very little from, you know, he had no grandparents when he was growing up. We found so much in his mother's things when his mum died and all her paperwork came to him. She had a folder, and in this folder are her alien cards that she had to present whenever she was stopped in the street because she was German. There were also a series of letters, 3 or 4 letters, because she had employed an agent to go to Germany to try and find her parents. And these 3 letters, the first one says, "I've been to your apartment. The neighbours say that your parents were taken to this ghetto." The second one says something about going to the ghetto. And the third one said 3 people survived from this place. And then there's this line that says, "I'm really sorry to say that your parents were dead, but I can assure you that they didn't suffer." So I don't know how she managed to live a life and be amazing and sane and bring up two children. And she had all this that lived in her background. And, you know, not just her, many people do. And there are so many people still living through similar things now. Refugees every day, nowhere to go, and nobody to look after them. There's other children maybe with tiny little hairs that they keep in their pockets. I like to think it was a present from her mother.
It's a beautiful story, Jackie. Thank you. We're going to a piece of paper now as an object. Why a piece of paper?
Paper, notebooks, there's something about blank paper that really calls to my soul. I just want to damage it with marks. I just want to put paint on it. I just want to write on it. And there's something about a blank notebook that is, it's just waiting, isn't it, for stories, words. I love handwriting, which is like drawing words.
Yeah. So you're not someone who's terrified by the blank space. There are some authors and they'll stare at a blank screen at a computer and go, wow, okay, this just got real. But yeah. You don't. You just say, okay, this is an empty space for me to fill with my creativity.
You know, you don't want to waste a piece of paper, but the only way that you can learn and be creative is by being willing to embrace the possibility that you're going to make mistakes. The only way that you can get better is by making mistakes and learning from them.
We've talked about The Lost Words, which is, of course, has these beautiful nature sounds by Chris Watson, the sound recordist who has worked with David Attenborough. And as this is audio, it'd be remiss of us not to play a bit of that. So let's go to the opening poem now.
Acorn. As flake is to blizzard, as curve is to sphere, as knot is to net, as one is to many, as coin is to money, as bird is to flock, as rock is to mountain, as drop is to fountain, as spring is to river, as glint is to glitter, as near is to far, as wind is to weather, as feather is to flight, as light is to star, as kindness is to good, so acorn is to wood.
That was The Lost Words by Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris, read there by Elbow's lead singer Guy Garvey. Other narrators are Keris Matthews, Benjamin Zephaniah and Edith Bowman. It is available to buy and download now. There's a link in the programme notes of this episode. There's also a link for the aforementioned audiobook of The House Without Windows. Now, audiobooks are most certainly having a moment, and this one won at the New York Radio Awards. How did it feel to win that award?
It's great. The audiobook is astonishing. It's illustrated throughout with this beautiful soundscapes by Chris Watson. But you don't do the work to win awards, do you?
No.
The awards that I love are the ones where somebody says, I sleep with your book under my pillow, or I couldn't get my child away from the computer, but now I can't get it away from your book. That's a nice one.
They are absolutely awards. Now, just a reminder before we go, please do tell all your friends about the Penguin podcast and please rate, comment and subscribe. You can also find us on your Alexa-enabled device. So what's next, Jackie?
Later this year, The Lost Spells comes out and life becomes very hectic unless we're all still in lockdown and I can stay home and be a hermit. I have two books out at the moment. One is called Mrs. Noah's Garden, and it's written by me but illustrated by James Mayhew, and it's beautiful, beautiful. And then I also have what started off as one book called The Unwinding and then became two books because I asked the publisher if they would take out all my words and just leave the pictures. So you know how you get colouring in books for adults? Well, this is like a colouring in book for writers because there's all the pictures there, but there's space to put your own words in.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Jackie, to catch up with you today.
Thank you.
Made me think a lot about the world.
I'll be off to put my feet in the sea again then.
Oh, I want to see the pups.
The seal pups.
Yeah, tweet a picture of your seal pups, please.
Yeah, I will do. Okay. Yeah.
Take care, Jackie.
Thank you.
An inspiration to a generation, Michelle Obama invites us on a journey through her life, from childhood in Chicago to college years in prison and finally to the White House. Filled with wisdom and compassion, Becoming is an honest memoir by one of the most important women of the 21st century.
I spent much of my childhood listening to the sound of striving. It came in the form of bad music, or at least amateur music, coming up through the floorboards of my bedroom. The plink, plink, plink of students sitting downstairs at my great Aunt Robbie's piano, slowly and imperfectly learning their scales. My family lived in the South Shore neighborhood of Chicago, in a tidy brick bungalow that belonged to Robbie and her husband, Terry.
The audiobook edition of Becoming is available to download now.